everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, this time covering chapters 23 through 26 of part 2. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series.
Before we start, my fellow harpies, we have a couple new blog posts up from Beatrice Groves on our website, and I really enjoyed these.
Me too.
In part one, she's looking at the I Ching epigraphs and wondering when J.K. Rowling chose them. She talks about an interview that J.K. Rowling gave about her process and the way she envisions inspiration and work, which I don't think I remember. It was absolutely fascinating to read that.
It really is. I've seen it discussed a few places because it was a fantastic interview.
In part two, she's reflecting on her predictions for The Running Grave that she did for us on a previous post, which ones worked out, which ones didn't, and she's looking at some of the religious language in the book, which I found really interesting because there are definite themes of spirituality, and baptism is a big one in the book. Mm-hmm. I believe we're going to talk about that in the next episode, but these posts are already up on our blog section of the website. We'll be sure to link to them, so please go check them out and let us and B know what you think.
Yes.
So the Q&A for this episode, without revealing too much, can you share some of the challenges and dangers that Robin encounters when she first infiltrates the cult?
Robin is putting herself in physical danger in a way that she's never done before. I don't want to give too much away, but for women in the cult, once successfully indoctrinated, there is a duty that is dangerous. I can't say any more, but yeah, she's really putting herself physically in harm's way and emotionally too. This sort of thing really takes an emotional toll. And of course, she's separated from any kind of support system, which is, you know, cult 101. The first thing they do is try and weaken family ties. And they will even, the Universal Humanitarian Church will even split up people who join the cult together. So there's a very deliberate attempt to weaken any personal ties so that your loyalty flows upwards, can't flow sideways. You can't form alliances with people on your level. Yeah, so it's very, very, very testing.
Jo said on Twitter that she didn't base the UHC off of any cult in particular, but here she's saying that there are parallels, and we've made parallels to Scientology, to the FLDS, that one cult I talked about with the snake in the mailbox. I can't remember the name.
Neither can I, but Synanon? I do remember. Synanon sounds...
Is that it?
Yeah, that sounds
familiar.
That sounds right.
Lots of people, including my own brother, have been telling me to watch the Mother of God documentary on HBO Max, and I did. Uh-huh. What's it called? Love Has Won.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Love Has Won, Mother
Incredibly
God.
Incredibly disturbing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We watched it too.
Oh my God.
So creepy.
Horrifying. That was a fun documentary.
I think the most disturbing thing was seeing the people who still believe being interviewed, because that's how I imagine a Becca.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We also watched Twin Flames on Netflix.
Watched that one too.
No, I still got to watch that one.
You haven't watched it yet, Kenz?
I haven't yet. Honestly, the Mother God one was just so fucking creepy that I needed to take a minute after that one.
Twin Flames is just stupid. It's just so fucking stupid.
It's like if a cult met a dating show.
Yeah.
It's the weirdest thing.
It's like MLM. But I'm like, this guy is the least charismatic person I've ever seen. I see him once, I want to punch him in the face. How did he get people to go along with this?
It would be really interesting to ask Jo what bit she took from actual cults. She said she's into them, though. I bet she's watched all these documentaries, too.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm.
They're all so different, but they also share so many similarities. I guess at the end of the day, the way to hurt and control other human beings comes down to similar things.
Yeah, it really does. All of the cults, they have this different, you know, flashy wrapping on the outside. Aliens, magic, spirit world, creepy sex shit, whatever. But the core principles of control, they're always the same, right? You set it up so that you control behavior, information, thought, and emotion. And they use the same techniques. I was reading about more cults today, and there are so many that, just like the UHC, they cobble together bits from a bunch of different religions and spiritualities in real life, which, one, I guess it's easier than just like making it up wholesale. Yeah. Because they're like, oh, we'll just steal it. And I feel like it also provides like a familiar entry point for recruiting people. Mm-hmm. I found this great website called cultfacts.com. It has a bunch of straightforward organized fact sheets about a ton of different cults, so many. And what's fun for me is that you can browse by like the features of the cult. So you can look at all the doomsday cults. You can look at all the UFO cults, all the different cults that do arranged marriages or anti-medicine or all that different stuff.
Weird.
It's great. And it's got some like obscure ones. It's just a huge catalog of the different cults. Fun browsing.
Sounds like my Saturday night is planned.
I know, right?
It's sorted.
Yep. Cultfacts.com.
Anyway, back to Strike and Robin. Hearing the answer is heart-wrenching, though, because of everything we know Robin has to go through.
You know what? I'm just so proud of Robin in this book. Like, we're proud of Strike. I'm proud of Robin, too, because she went through hell in this cult. She did. And it made her stronger. She came out stronger. She came out committed to justice. Even more so. She brought this church down. She saved so many people, both people in the cult now and people who would have joined in the future. Robin Ellicott, my hero.
That David Bowie song is for her, no one else.
Yes.
We got a listener question that I feel like kind of goes with this. Mm-hmm. It was posted on Instagram from Karina, and she said, I've been mulling this over in my head without talking to any fans about it so far. Do you think Robin is a bit too selfless and recklessly brave in this book? I don't want to feel this way, but I guess I was a tiny bit annoyed by it. Her bravery was always there, but somehow in this book, it was a bit too much for me and made her seem more like a book character, less like a real person, and also less professional as a detective. Would love to hear your thoughts. So I haven't been shy about saying when I think that Robin has behaved recklessly in previous books, mostly in Blackheart.
You have not been.
But this is not one of those times for me. I know I'm speculating here, Karina, but maybe the trouble you're having is relating to it, which I totally get because there is no way that I could have ever done what she did. But this isn't a time where I'd call her reckless because they did as much as they could to prepare. And it's not as if people haven't done brave things like this in real life and gone undercover.
Yeah.
It takes an incredible amount of bravery, but I don't think it's an unrealistic portrayal of things real people have done. And I think it fits Robin's character really well. Mm-hmm. I'm confused by how it makes her less professional as a detective, though, because I don't think we'd say that of real detectives who go undercover.
No, I agree with you, Lindsay. I think Robin did an absolutely amazing job this book in terms of managing risks. I will say she did better in this book than in Ink Black Heart in that respect.
Oh,
yeah. And definitely. I was on her side in Ink Black Heart, but I still feel, she's improved. Because when she went undercover, neither she nor Strike thought it would be as dangerous as it turned out to be, but they couldn't really have known. Mm-hmm. They both did the most that they could do to prepare, and Robin especially. And the thing is that once she is undercover at this cult, she had no choice but to do what she had to in order to survive and get the job done that she came there to do.
Yeah.
I think she was actually quite careful when she was in the cult. I was expecting her to do stuff like sneak around and break into Mazu's office and through files and stuff. And I was so nervous about it, but she didn't. I actually can't think of anything really reckless she did in there that wasn't an understandable response to whatever was happening in the moment.
Yeah.
Like, should she have gotten out sooner? Maybe. But I completely understand her wanting to make sure that she had what she needed to take them down after what she'd seen and been through.
It would feel so pointless if she...
I know, if she just... She would have gone through all that for nothing. And then after she got out, I think she was actually much more careful than she used to be. She stayed in the office overnight that one time. She took Strike's concerns more seriously for the most part and balanced them, I think, with her own very reasonable risk assessment.
Yeah, that's a great point about after her getting out. I totally agree. This is exactly what I was hoping would happen as a solution, where they both take a step forward and meet more in the middle. And I think they nailed it as best they could in this book.
I think so too. All Strike needs to do is stop using the word prance and pissing Robin off with
it. So funny when he does it.
Every fucking time he goes straight to it.
I'd appreciate it if when we had discussions like
every
this.
Every fucking time, Strike, I don't prance. I am not a pony.
I know what he's trying to accomplish with that.
Yeah.
That she's casual about it.
Still very insulting.
You know, it's why it's so funny.
Yeah, it is. Anyway.
Okay, should we go to chapter 23?
Yeah, let's do it. I'm excited.
So in this chapter, Robin takes the bus to Chapman Farm. The epigraph for this chapter, nine at the beginning, means fellowship with men at the gate. And that is from hexagram 13, fellowship with men.
I think the way this directly relates to the chapter is that Robin is meeting with the others at the gate. or not quite inside, mm-hmm. but on the way.
This hexagram is so appropriate for the image of the church that's being presented by Becca on this bus, because it says, true fellowship among men must be based upon a concern that is universal. It is not the private interests of the individual that create lasting fellowship among men, but rather the goals of humanity. And that's just what the UHC claims to be, concerned with the universal benefit of humanity. It's literally in the name.
They're like Grindelwald.
Oh, yeah, just like Grindelwald.
They're doing the greater good thing, really, yeah. to do their evil plotting.
But here's where it all goes wrong. The hexagram says, in order to bring about this sort of fellowship, a persevering and enlightened leader is needed. And though Wace appears to be this leader, he's only in it for himself. He's a con man. The leader is rotten. So the whole core of the UHC is rotten. They can never achieve true fellowship for these goals.
Should we start the chapter by addressing some of the concerns we've had about listening to the cult chapters? Because a few people have said that they don't know if they can listen because they're stressful. You know, before we even heard people saying this, we knew that we needed to keep everything as light and fun as possible. And we promise we're going to do our best to make sure it's always fun.
Yep. The Striking Ellicott Files, making cults fun since 2023.
That's our new motto, I guess.
Yeah. I got rereading the cult chapters. It's hard because it's so miserable. But the benefit of listening to us do it is that you don't have to reread it.
Yeah, you don't have to.
You can remember the vital bits, but it's more thinking about all of what it means, you know?
Yeah,
it's exactly. not the same experience at all.
But I just want to put that out there.
Yeah.
That's been in the top of all of our minds, I think, when we're doing notes and preparing and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
The chapter opens up with Robin showing up for the bus to leave for Chapman Farm, and it says, for a moment, she stood with her half-empty holdall over her shoulder, looking around at taxis, swarming commuters, and buses, and experienced a moment of panic.
When I first read this, I remember thinking, finally, Robin's having a normal reaction to joining a cult. Panic seems very appropriate, especially considering that they know that it's dangerous. And because I had been panicking since I read the synopsis. And then I read she felt panic because she didn't see a bus. And I was like, Robin.
Oh my God. Yeah, it's literally the opposite. Panicking because she might not be able to make it into the cult. It's like, oh shit, did I miss the bus to the nightmare torture farm of horrors? Whereas you and I would be like, we'd be like, oh no,
can't make
the bus, let's reschedule for never. But see, this is why Robin Ellicott is a badass protagonist, and why the most exciting part of my day is when my cat wakes up from her nap and comes to ask for pets. I'm not a protagonist. I couldn't do this.
No, I couldn't do it either. I was really afraid that the panic was going to hit her out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely better that it happens here than when she's actually at Chapman Farm, right?
I guess, but it never really does.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it shows how much she's grown since Lethal White, because...
Oh, for sure.
Obviously, Robin of Lethal White couldn't have done this.
Maybe she just finally hit the peak trauma and she's like, all right, more trauma, add it to the pile.
Aw.
But Robin, no, she knows techniques how to deal with it better. Mm. She's like, she's been hardened like a diamond under pressure, but a little bit.
Robin spots a sign with the UHC logo and we see Becca and Jang.
By the way, quick side note, I noticed that one of the meanings of the name Jang is river. And then I looked Tayo up and one of those meanings was large wave, so both related to water, possibly.
Lots of water.
Yeah, I feel like there's some sort of important liquid joke to be made there, but it's not quite coming to me.
Well, water is a very important liquid.
Very important
it
liquid.
It is.
As we've learned previously. It's probably connecting the theme of water, which feels very dangerous in this book with the drownings and everything. And these two men are dangerous. So maybe that's where it's at.
Yeah, because a large wave, that'll sweep you over.
It will.
It's interesting that Mazu's name is, she's a sea goddess.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
She's named all of her sons after water. It feels like she's reigning sort of over them a little bit.
Yeah.
It's weird that she managed to marry a guy whose name, last name Wace, is connected to water as well.
Is it?
Yeah, Wace. It could mean either giant sea monster or land surrounded by water.
Okay.
But it's connected to water as well.
Well, I like him as a giant sea monster and her a sea goddess because it's like they're controlling.
Like she's riding the giant sea serpent.
Yeah.
That imagery makes sense to me.
Also just reminds me of the time we were at the beach and a sea lion jumped out of the wave and slapped my cousin across the face.
That's amazing.
It was so funny. God,
that's so good. I love that.
This next bit with Becca is super creepy. It says, Becca, Robin noticed, was observing the passengers in a mirror positioned directly over the windscreen, which was angled to watch the seats rather than the road. The slight movement of Becca's right shoulder suggested that she was making notes.
I love that Robin has realized that Becca is watching them, but Becca has no idea that she's being watched right back.
I found this bit so ominous. It's a peek behind the curtain of Becca's cheery girl guide veneer to the very deliberate and skilled way that the church is surveilling and controlling its members. But like mm-hmm. you said, Lindsay, the fact that Robin notices and isn't noticing, it's setting up, I feel like, her eventual triumph over the church's manipulation and cruelty, because she's better than them. She's going to outwit, outsmart, outlast.
You're quoting Survivor right now, but yeah.
I think I got it in the wrong order, though.
Nina's going to be disappointed in me if I don't know the order.
Oh, what is the order?
It's outwit, outplay, outlast.
Outwit, outplay, that's a tongue twister. Outwit, outplay,
outlast.
Outlast. Robin's going to do that to them.
Anyway, it didn't make me feel any better about Becca.
Yeah, this is where I was already starting to get kind of nervous, because the vibes here really are similar to Mazu, like that feeling of constantly being watched and monitored and observed.
Very panopticon.
When Becca asks everyone if they've read the answer, it says that Robin had deliberately decided not to read it so she'd have a pretext for asking questions and to appear to be someone that needed to be convinced.
So smart. The title of this book being The Answer made me immediately think of The Secret. Did anyone else think of that?
I don't know that.
Oh, Oprah was into it. She did a thing on it. My mom was fully into The Secret, but it's like where the manifesting comes from. I don't think that the two have much in common, because it seems Wace's book is partly autobiography, partly rambling about his culty philosophies. But to me, the magical aspects of it, of the manifestation in The Secret and going pure spirit in The Answer, it seems to like resonate with each other.
The part of Wace's book being autobiographical, it probably makes people feel more connected to him, which probably contributes to that attachment that people feel to him.
It's very much a cult of personality, right? Because Wace's personality is what's drawing people into this cult a lot of the time. That's a big draw for people.
All right, let's talk about the questionnaire that Robin has to fill out.
Yes. Listen, I love personality tests a lot. I know. Any kind of thing that sorts people into types and tells me which type I am, I'm going to eat it up. Hogwarts House, star sign, MBTI, Enneagram, like what type of onion are you quizzes on BuzzFeed. Yeah, they're great. I'm all over it. And I know that these systems are all nonsense, and I don't actually make decisions or judgments based on them, but you know what they are is fun. And I think it's something to do with like this fundamental urge to organize and sort of label the universe so that it makes sense. There are so many different ways to impose order on the world. And one of them is to neatly sort yourself and everyone around you into tiny little categories so that you have a shortcut to understanding them.
Surprisingly, not really. I'm the opposite, because I really dislike these kinds of things. I'm like, don't tell me what I am, because especially when you're given these answers, I've looked at the results, right? I can see myself in all of those things.
Right.
I don't know. It's like a way of controlling the way you think about yourself, and it's like limiting.
I can see it being limiting. Yeah.
I noticed that you threw in Hogwarts House.
Yeah.
Trying to at me for being a strong Hufflepuff.
Well, you are. You do think of yourself as a Hufflepuff, don't you?
Absolutely. But here's the thing. Uh-huh. I would never say that based on like a sorting quiz online, because that's nonsense. It's as nonsensical as all these other things to me. Okay. For me, identifying with Hufflepuff House is because of the values given.
Oh, okay.
Justice and fairness are the ones that I most strongly relate to. Okay. So that's me choosing something. It's not like I didn't pick which element do I like best and get Hufflepuff as a result.
Okay. That makes sense to me.
But obviously the UHC is asking these questions for particular reasons. So I thought it would be fun to kind of go through the questions and figure out what they're trying to find out about these people.
Ooh, okay. Yeah.
So here's the first question. Once I make up my mind, I seldom change it.
I think this one is important. They want people who are going to buy what they're selling and never ask for a refund.
But on the other hand, maybe they want, you know, people who pride themselves on being open-minded and considering ideas so that they can get sort of sucked into it, right?
Maybe.
I feel like either answer, they're going to be able to recruit this cult member.
I think you're proving my point that these are all useless. Let's keep going.
Yeah, okay. Regardless of how they answer, they know how to manipulate them. All right. The next question is, I prefer to work at my own pace.
I'm not quite sure about this one. They might prefer people who say no because they're easier to boss around.
Yeah. If you say no, you're more likely to want like a structure imposed upon you, like the cult does. What does this test actually do other than have Zhao give you a different tincture or something? Do they keep this on file and sort of consult these results? Do they use it to put them into their groups? Like, what are they doing with this test?
Finding out where these people's weaknesses are and what they can manipulate is my assumption. Just making
notes about them to put into their file. Okay, that makes sense.
And the next one. I have many friends and acquaintances.
Clearly, they don't want this.
No.
Oh, they want people. Would anyone notice if you disappeared?
Yeah, they're just gathering information with this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the next one. People like to come to me with their problems.
I'm guessing they'd prefer someone who said no to this, just so they won't be forming close relationships with anyone else.
They won't be plotting.
Yeah, because you're not supposed to form horizontal connections. It's supposed to be all vertical.
Yeah, or looked at as a leader, yeah.
And then the last one, I gain satisfaction from achieving my goals.
This might be a good thing to answer yes or strongly agree to, because they might feel like you will work hard for them.
That's the stupidest question, though. Who doesn't gain satisfaction from achieving goals?
I've literally seen this question on tests, though.
Yeah, I have. I have a sneaking suspicion that Zhao stole these questions from some other personality typing system and just adapted it and changed the categories to suit this cult framework. Also, Zhao's training is as a psychologist. Do you think he'd know better than to buy into these personality typing test systems? But I don't think he's a particularly good doctor or concerned with medical or professional ethics.
No, I'm also not sure if he's buying into it or if it's just a useful tool to ask some questions and find things out about new recruits, like if they have lots of friends in the outside world. And also because they want to give people that sense of belonging, that feeling that they're special. I'm a whatever.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if he does buy into this, I guess it's not that weird because he is in a literal cult. So there's that.
Yes. Yeah. The logic and the critical thinking are not the strong suits of the cult mentality.
I loved the part where Robin noticed that the pens that Becca had handed out were numbered and she chose to keep hers accidentally.
That felt scary to me. That's the scariest thing so far. I'm like, you kept a pen that you were supposed to give back? Just to see what would happen. This is anarchy.
And Robin breaking rules.
I know. I couldn't have done it. Drake would have no problem, obviously. He steals office supplies all the time. But this is, for me, a first look at the scary level of control that the UHC has inside the farm. So at first, I might think that these pens are numbered to save money or something. But in reality, it's because the UHC doesn't let people have any means of expressing themselves that aren't tightly controlled. Like, the only writing permitted is in the journals they give you, and with the pencil that's literally tied to the journal. That's it.
I think there's also something, too, about wanting to see who is going to follow what they're supposed to do and who they should be watching.
Oh, you think it's a test, too?
I think it's a test, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'd also been wondering if that's one of those first ways that they start to kind of test people and see who might end up being, like, a problem later.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, too. They stopped for a quick break at the bathroom. It says, knowing what lay ahead, she felt a strong desire to buy chocolate, even though she wasn't hungry. Instead, she examined the front pages of a newspaper in the shop.
I was yelling at her to buy and eat some chocolate here because it's her last chance.
I was definitely begging her to eat something before going in there. It just reminds me of the line from the Joni Mitchell song, Big Yellow Taxi, where it's, don't it always seem to go?
That you don't know what you got till it's gone.
Yeah. I wonder if Robin, being a Joni fan and all, if she ever thought about that at any point while she was there.
Oh, I bet she did.
Chocolate or strike, it works for both of them.
Aww.
I wonder what would have happened if she would have bought something to eat and took it on the bus, because I don't feel like they really had the freedom to do that. It seems like there's an unspoken rule. It would have been looked badly upon. I think it would have been another mark against her.
A faux pas.
Yep. I do love the mention of chocolate here, since we know she'll be getting her weekly chocolate fix thanks to strike soon.
I love how the chocolate is as much about fortifying her mentally as physically. There are more efficient ways to get calories and protein into her when she's on a starvation diet. She'd have gotten more physical benefit from some protein bars. Mm. But the chocolate, it's about pleasure and happiness. And obviously, as we all know, it's about keeping the dementors away. It goes beyond just physical sustenance. It has like a higher psychological purpose, and it's comfort.
I think I've seen some talk somewhere about who was behind the idea of giving Robin chocolate. I think that it was Strike, just because of how well he knows her and because he's an amazing gift giver when he wants to be.
Yes. Oh, it's his love language.
Yeah, it is. I think that is very much a loving thing that was done. I think it came from Strike.
Oh, of course it did. That's so sweet.
I know it might be a stretch, but Robin sees newspapers here, and she sees the newspapers on her last day in the UHC when she's watching over Jacob.
She also sees them on the day when she's allowed to go out that once and collect money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was kind of thinking that it was her first and last days at the UHC are kind of bookmarked with news from the outside world, but you're right, there's that bit too. It feels like it's used as a string connecting her to the outside world.
It really does. These little points where she gets to see what's happening are like markers that show us the time passing and just how much of it is passing. So these three moments of news with huge gaps between them. At the start, it's that the Brexit referendum is coming. The next time she sees it, it's happened. Leave has won. And then the final time, it talks about Cameron resigning in the wake of Brexit, and Theresa May is in charge now. Brexit was such a huge issue that absolutely dominated the news cycles. And Robin has basically missed the entire thing except for these three little peeks into it.
The speech that Becca gives about the UHC's main charitable concerns and how the acts of service they'll all be providing are saving the world. It's just so obnoxious.
The thing that I think annoys me the most about, oh, we're helping all of these people who are vulnerable or whatever, but don't like quite a few of those people end up being like roped into all of the culty bullshit and the baby trafficking and stuff. So you're just taking them from one shitty situation to another.
It's literally the sole purpose of their charitable concerns is recruitment.
It's just so vile, preying on vulnerable people in shitty situations like that.
Anyway, speaking of Becca, here's where she opens the floor up for questions. And I gotta say, I would have some very urgent questions. But so obviously this question from the green-haired girl that we later learn is Penny is the most important question. And it is, how quickly do most people go pure spirit, which is basically, so how soon do I get my magic superpowers?
Yeah.
Which is such a teenage question. She and her little friend have obviously been lured in by this promise of being able to fly and open doors and make things explode or whatever, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty good promise. I mean, I grew up watching Alex Mack and Out of This World shows where the teenage girls had magic powers. Sign me up.
The next brilliant question that Becca gets is, do we get to choose our groups?
I know this is pure speculation, and it doesn't really matter since it didn't happen, but for the first time, I am wondering how it would have gone if the agency had sent two people in.
Ooh. You know what they should have done? They should have sent Deborah Barkley in for just a week after Robin had been in there for a little while, because there were times when other buses of recruits showed up to do their like week of service, right? They could have gone just for the retreat so that they could check in with Robin in person, get the vibes, get a chance to talk to her, and then just nope out at the baptism. Yeah. Be like, nah, I'm good. See ya.
That would have been good.
But to answer your question, I'm sure that if two of them had gone in, they'd have pretended not to know each other. Yeah. So they might have actually gotten put in the same group.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I know it's less likely since both of the men have children, but if they had sent Dev or Barkley in, they could have pretended to go to the retreat room and had a full 20 minutes of privacy to talk. Yeah. It might have been a problem for Robin later, though. I admit there's pros and cons to this, but it's fun to think about.
Yeah, I love this sort of alternate universe. What would they have done if they'd seen them try to drown Robin? They would have broken cover and gone to get her out of the pool.
Oh my God.
They'd have put her out of the box, 100%. Anyway, but moving on, this next question. As someone in academia, this made me laugh because Walter, the professor, asks, if we have a specific skill set that might be useful to the church, should we declare it so we can be of more use? Because you know this guy's talking about himself, right? But dude, you're a professor of anthropological philosophy. The skills of thinking and research are literally the opposite of what this cult wants.
We all knew he's asking this because he wanted to talk about his skills and feel important.
100%. He's like, I'm a philosophy professor. I can rise pure spirit to the top of this church
in no time. And then the last question, what do you say to people who claim the UHC is actually a cult? Asked Amandeep.
I remember quietly gasping at this, like, oh, did he say that for real?
I know, right? It's a bit like saying Voldemort's name in Harry Potter, isn't it? Like, I think I half expected something terrible to happen to him, you know, because he mentioned the C word out loud.
Yeah, it's funny to think because he's there to try and prove it too, right?
I just think it's so funny. I had such high hopes for him. You know, I was wondering whether or not he and Robin were going to team up or something, but then he joins the cult. And
yeah, he's so excited about it too.
It's the ones who are the smartest who think that they can defend against it who can't actually. I read that in that Stephen Hassan book. Amandeep was a prime target for this cult. He really was.
In answering his question, though, I was going to say that the way to tell if something is a cult is when everyone has to escape over the fence in the middle of the night, because that's something that I've seen Leah Remedy say in regards to Scientology, because that happens a lot there. Mm-hmm. But after watching both the Love Has Won and the Twin Flame documentaries, where they were not...
compound. They didn't have the barbed wire compound.
Yeah, they seemed free to leave. I guess it really does come down to mind control and the inability to think for yourself.
Yeah, although I think the Twin Flames guy is trying to build a compound that's definitely going to have a barbed wire fence.
I know. That was concerning.
Very concerning.
Because that's still going.
So the final question is Marion asking if Papa Jay will be there. Mm. And you can just tell that this woman is here for one reason.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Marion and I have very different reactions to the news that he will be there.
Yeah.
You mean you're not overjoyed to see Jonathan Wace? I'm shocked.
I'm not. Yeah. This made me think, I'm wondering if there's psychological reasons why cult leaders give themselves names like this. Papa Jay, Mama Mazu, right?
I suppose it's all about supplanting one's closest personal relationships, isn't it? So cutting out someone's actual parents, the first and most important figures of authority and love in someone's life, and then taking that spot yourself.
Yeah, and then they end up as a result with this deeply rooted attachment and need for their love and approval for this new parental figure that's ends up being really hard to break.
Yeah.
It's a smart tactic to keep people loyal to you.
It's playing on the most fundamental connections.
Okay. Should we go to chapter 24?
Yeah.
All right. In chapter 24, Robin arrives at Chapman Farm and meets her fellow recruits.
The epigraph for chapter 24 reads, "The dark force possesses beauty but veils it. So must a man be when entering the service of a king." That's from Hexagram 2, The Receptive.
Pools, I'm going to let you take the lead on the whole hexagram and being a receptive thing. But obviously, being a receptive is to follow someone else's lead, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what all of these people are doing here as they enter the UHC. I think we can apply this especially to Robin, as we're supposed to do, because not only is she following orders, but she's veiling her true self.
Yes. This is such a genius epigraph because Robin is absolutely posing as the receptive. She's being what Tayo said she was. The receptive is what the cult wants. Like you said, it's what everyone else is following. But we know that Robin is really the creative acting in this role to achieve her purposes. She's the active principal. So she is veiling the beauty that she possesses as a receptive would. So beauty here meaning purpose and skills and her true self. But she's not doing it as a receptive, which is to be humble, to allow someone else to take credit, to do the quiet work and let the creative shine. She's doing it to achieve her own active ends of burning this church to the ground.
I know we always say how much we love it when J.K. Rowling updates her Twitter headers. The opening line of this chapter is such a good example of why we love it. Mm-hmm. After about a half an hour, Robin finally saw the sign for Lion's Mouth, a narrow tree-lined road. And this was one of the most fun headers that I think she's given us for this book.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I just love the symbolism of Robin having to literally go into the lion's mouth here. It's such a perfect illustration of the danger that she's walking into.
You think Jo gets really excited when she finds something that works this well?
Yeah, 100%.
On the horizon beyond the farm, Robin spotted a tall, circular tower that looked like the rook of a chess-playing giant.
I am trying to find some sort of connection here with this tower or just explore the idea of it. Mm-hmm. I don't have a fully formed thought, but I know that it really represents mystery and fear for Strike. You know, he goes there seeking something that day, healing, answers. Strike saw this as a child when he was at the farm, and now Robin's seeing it here. I don't know, is it an anchor? It feels like this is now a shared experience that they both had seeing this tower in the distance.
I love that idea of it being an anchor for them.
I feel like the fact that for both of them, the tower appears kind of ominous and mysterious, but in actuality, it's this church, this place of healing. There's something there with being at the farm and the UHC blocking the knowledge of of healthier, more genuine spiritual insight and connection. By being on the farm, your view of this church is shrouded, right? You can't see it properly. But I need to think more on this. So it's lucky that this tower is coming back.
Yeah, exactly. I like where you're going with it. We'll come back to it.
But this tower comes up so often as like a visual symbol of being in the church. So perhaps near to spirituality, but separated from it and not being able to see it.
Yeah.
Is something there.
When they arrive, they go to a locker room where they place their belongings down and change into a tracksuit.
I think it was Zoe Song who pointed this out to me a while back, but the tracksuits being orange gives me major prison vibes. I don't know if that's a British thing where prisoners wear orange.
I looked it up and the uniform is like soft gray trousers, blue shirt, and like gray sweater or something. But I think that being handed an orange tracksuit to wear would have had me turning right back around and walking out. I cannot wear orange. It does not work for me. I look hideous.
You need to kill the false self, Pools.
I refuse. I'm never going to go pure spirit. I am way too attached to the materialist concept of colors looking good next to my face.
Well, you're never going to be able to open doors with your magical powers then.
No, I guess I'll just have to open them by...
with your regular hands.
With my regular hands. Silly, but yeah, no. Orange jumpsuit, orange tracksuit? Absolutely not. I'm out.
You're out. That's your line, orange.
Yeah.
Pools, you said something a couple episodes back, and I think I ended up taking it out of the episode, but now I'm thinking about it again because you were wondering what clothes Robin was wearing because she never gets these back.
No, she never gets them back. Well, maybe when they raided the farm, they eventually return her belongings.
Maybe. Anna Kiara pointed something out to me the other day that Robin is a sign locker 29, and she thinks that Joe probably picked this to line up with hexagram 29, which is the abysmal, a big hexagram for this book.
Oh, that's such a good catch. I feel like that's probably a hint for us that she's never going to see her stuff again since it's going into the abyss.
I just hope it's nothing she likes.
All right. One of the first things we see are windows to a quote unquote classroom and then a line of children.
I was very concerned when it said that all of the children had their hair basically shaved, probably for the same reasons why the whole head shaving thing bothers me in general.
Yeah.
But there's something just so awful about stripping children down and making them all the same. Because these children have no individual interests or hobbies. They're purposely getting rid of any uniqueness. And while it's awful for everyone, doing it to children just feels so much worse because these are formative years. They're just stripping these people who are like not fully formed yet from everything that makes them them.
It's so cruel. Like these children haven't chosen to be there at all. These children have literally no agency. They can't get out.
Yeah, 4 more months and they're going to be saved.
Yeah.
I know that we don't always agree with the Harry Potter parallel theories, but when you first read about this fountain, did either of you get the Ministry of Magic vibes with that horrible one that they have in the chapter where they infiltrate the ministry? Because I did a bit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Same sinister feeling.
I was actually thinking that this reminded me of the one Harry sees in Order of the Phoenix, the Fountain of Magical Brethren, because there's a bit of a parallel for me in that what looks beautiful and magical at first glance, he's like, oh, it's a beautiful fountain. I'll donate if I win. When you look closer at it, there's something dark underneath with the way everyone is gazing adoringly.
I don't know. I'm just thinking that there are creepy dead bodies in this fountain at the cult.
Okay.
And then the muggles down beneath they're giving me the same kind of...
the same vibe?
It's a creepy fountain.
I feel like it would be nice if it was in like a cemetery.
I don't love it.
Okay. We're a no on the fountain.
We're
a no on the fountain.
This is the first time that we see the whole putting water on your forehead and saying the drowned prophet will bless all who worship her thing.
Yeah. I was a little surprised that they came right out with this. I think here's where I would have been like, I'm out.
I would have already been gone because the orange outfits.
Right.
Yeah. The whole water on the forehead thing seemed totally normal to me coming from a Catholic background. Like you walk in, you touch the fountain water, you do the cross or whatever.
That's interesting because this feels very strange to me, but it's like the opposite of what we talked about before with the UHC service where that felt normal to me.
Yeah.
Opposite for you.
When they go back outside after they do the whole dorm thing, we get the first appearance of Lynn. And I feel like the level of detail we get indicates that she's going to be an important character. Because it says, among them was a teenage girl, 16 at most, who had long, fine, mousy hair, sunbleached at the ends, and enormous dark blue eyes in a thin, anxious face. She smiled automatically at the sight of the newcomers, but Robin, glancing back, saw the smile disappear from the girl's face as though a switch had been flicked. Note here that she has dark blue eyes, just like Wace and Abigail.
Oh, yeah, I didn't catch that.
It's a sign of her parentage.
Yeah.
I also want to note that the smile disappearing as if a switch had been flicked, because it's a hint that Lynn isn't happy in this place. Yeah. And when we get Will's smile being described as fixed in just a few paragraphs from now, I feel like it's setting up this tiny connection between them, as well as giving us the overall shiny facade hiding a dark, miserable underbelly atmosphere for this place.
And we know that it's because of their daughter that both of them feel that way. So it's almost like, you know, having that child saved both of them.
Oh, yeah.
Tayo divides them all into groups, and we have five groups total.
I have to say this really quickly, because I know we already mentioned the statue thing and the Ministry of Magic, but the whole description of Chapman Farm did give me a bit of a Hogwarts vibe, if Hogwarts was the most depressing place on the earth. So we have the dining hall with the head table, made me think of the Great Hall. There are dormitories, there's a library, and now they're being sorted.
Yeah.
But again, it's not in the nice way like it is at Hogwarts. It's about separating potential bonds, who Tayo wants to sleep with.
It's Hogwarts, but all the students are the house elves. And they're not allowed to learn magic. They're just working themselves to the bone and having no rights and being brainwashed to love it.
They need Hermione to give them spew.
Give Robin clothes so that Robin can be free.
I guess Strike's t-shirt will count as her item of clothing.
Oh my God. Strike gave Robin a t-shirt. Robin is free. Oh my God.
The groups are wood, metal, water, fire. And we don't see the other group's name, but I think we can assume that it's earth, since these are the phases or elements in Chinese philosophy.
Oh, cultural appropriation.
Gasp.
Why hasn't the UHC been canceled yet? But what's interesting about this to me, though, is that these elements, they're actually part of an interconnected cycle in the Wuxing. Each is strengthened or weakened by other elements, and each strengthens or weakens them in turn, right? It's all equal in a cycle. But it's clear that at Chapman Farm, there are value judgments attached to these groups. They are a hierarchy, and some of them are firmly at the top, and others are at the bottom, where people are sent as punishment or because they're not useful to do like menial labor and work their hands to the bone. And I feel like this is another way in which the UHC does the thing that they're appropriating completely wrong.
Yeah, I was going to look up what each of these elements mean in Chinese philosophy to see if Jo made Robin be part of fire group because it fits her personality or something. But I don't really think that that's what it is. I think she's in fire group because she's going to burn it all down.
Oh, I love that.
Robin's first task is to help in the crafting room. Not a bad assignment, in my opinion. And she's seated right next to Louise Purbright, who she knows is the mother of Kevin, Becca, and Emily.
We are also introduced to Wen here. And she's used as an example of the good that UHC's hostels do. The activity leader says that she was in a very bad situation and they helped. She's not in any better situation now, guys. But do you think we're meant to assume that she was pregnant when she arrived at the hostel and that they recruited her hard just so that Mazu could steal her Chinese baby?
That's the impression that I've always had.
That was what I had too.
Yeah.
And if so, it was like, did they have a standing order to look for pregnant, vulnerable Chinese women?
I'm sure they do.
Because that's...
Or just any pregnant woman.
Yeah, any pregnant women.
But Mazu's like, I'll keep this one.
Oh.
In response to Robin telling Louise that it's a coincidence that she's there, since it was Rowena's friend who was first interested in the UHC, Louise says there's no such thing as a coincidence and tells the fable of the blind turtle. The blind turtle who lives in the depths of the ocean and surfaces once every 100 years, the Buddha said, imagine there was a yolk floating on the ocean, and he asked what the chances that the old blind turtle would surface at exactly the point that meant his neck would pass through the yolk. That's how hard it is to find enlightenment for most people.
In most of the versions of this that I see on Google, Buddha compares the chances of the turtle meeting the yolk as greater than the chance of being born.
Yeah, I think in the Buddhist worldview, it's talking about the chance of being born specifically human in the cycle of rebirth, rather than as like a lower life form. And that because of this, the moral of the story is one should appreciate every moment and use every moment of your life to strive for liberation from suffering or reaching, which actually kind of reminds me of what Abigail says later, that she wants to live because there's just not enough time in the world to not be at Chapman Farm.
I also saw that Buddha said that it might be difficult, but not impossible. And the way I'm reading this and applying it to the book is to assign it to the task that Robin has just started undertaking. So it's going to be difficult to take this place down, but not impossible. Louise's final question is asking Robin if she had to take time off of work. And Robin says that she's actually not working at the moment. And I just found this funny because the exact opposite is true.
Yeah, she's literally working 24/7. Such an ironic ending to the chapter.
Okay, let's go to 25.
All right. In chapter 25, Jonathan Wace's daughter, Abigail Glover, calls Strike back to arrange an interview.
And the epigraph, "The correct place of the woman is within. The correct place of the man is without." And that's from hexagram 37, the family, the clan. Initially, I was trying to apply this to Strike and Abigail because they're the main ones in this chapter. But I don't really think that that's what it is. I think it's a bit literal that Strike is on the outside of the cult working and Robin is working on the inside.
Yeah, I agree. I interpreted it as the latter as well. We just finished with Robin, who is within the cult. Now we're looking at what Strike is doing without, on the outside. But this is one of those little brilliant reversals that Joe's playing with that I've been talking about, because the hexagram sees within as the place of the woman in the domestic sphere, providing nourishment of the family within the house, and the without as the masculine active place in the public sphere. But Robin's within is actually the active principle, the primary thrust of their investigation. And Strike's without is at the fringes investigating what he can, while Robin's doing the intense work and he's holding down the home, nourishing their children, the subcontractors.
Stretch that metaphor.
Might be veering off a bit off course there, but my point is, they're married. Robin is a badass. Strike would make a great stay-at-home dad. Barkley is their son.
Okay, got a bit weird.
Got a bit weird there at the end, but you get what I'm saying. It's flip-flopped upside down.
This is the very first time we have a Strike chapter, and I say that because I started thinking of them this way once they're split up, so a Robin chapter and a Strike chapter. Mm-hmm. And I remember feeling happy or relieved whenever we get to a Strike chapter, because it was just a break from the endless fear and horror. Did anyone else feel that way?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. It definitely helped break up all of those miserable culty bits.
Yeah, it did.
The nervousness of the effect of the affair with Bijou is nothing compared to the cult stuff. Like, I'll take that all day long.
Totally. Yeah, because at least we know that that's going to be over quickly and Strike wasn't going to get his head shaved or something. Not that that would be as bad as it happening to Robin, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So we start the chapter with Strike tailing Bigfoot, and it says his thoughts were entirely with Robin as he wondered what was happening right now at Chapman Farm, how she was finding her new environment, and whether she'd be able to find the plastic rock hidden just inside the perimeter fence. And I've got to say, every single time that Strike starts thinking about Robin while she's away in this book, it makes me squeal, it makes me kick my feet, because I cannot get over how in love with her he is, how much he misses her. I just love it.
Me too. And I appreciate you bringing this up, because we have been lacking in things to squeal about in this episode. So thank you. His thoughts were entirely with her. God, he's so in love with her.
He's so in love. I have to get my 5 minutes of, they're so cute. Out, you know.
What's the character's name in The Princess and the Frog? Tiana's friend.
Isn't it Charlotte?
Is it? There's that part of her where she's like holding something and kicking her feet.
That's exactly
that's
me.
That's how I'm picturing 100%.
The little newspaper.
Yeah.
That's 100% me.
Okay, so the description of Dev walking away as Strike approaches and then Dev calls Strike, it made me laugh because it took me right back to Ink Black Heart when Nutley is such an idiot and tries to talk to Robin that time she took over for him.
This makes me wonder if we're going to get another cursed subcontractor in book 8.
Mm.
Right? Because so far we've had sexual harasser, general misogynist. We've had complete incompetence. And we've had saboteur. What could be coming in this cursed job opening next?
I don't know. That'd be fun. I kind of enjoy having a subcontractor that we can all kind of dislike.
Some random ploy for us to root for getting fired, you know?
And then we get our first bit of tea about Little John here when Dev tells Strike that he found out that Little John had worked for Patterson before coming to them. Mm-hmm. I was so excited about this, honestly. It's just fun. I think that it was Lamp who said, or Badly Wired Lamp on Twitter, that we were due for a shady subcontractor, and she got that right.
Yeah, I'm so impressed by that. Good for her. I think that by this point in the book, I was still thinking Lil Jon might be a surprise good guy. But the instant we heard that he had a Patterson connection, I was like, oh, your days are numbered. This is very suspicious.
Now Strike gets a text from Bijou. And we got to go into this because, first of all, I did not notice that she uses an eggplant emoji. I think because I read this on on a tablet the first time, it was harder to make it out.
Yeah,
I'm dying now that I've realized this. I don't know why it's so funny. Maybe because he's a 41-year-old man getting an eggplant emoji.
Mm-hmm.
Do we think that Strike knows what the eggplant means is my question.
I think so.
Oh, yeah. I think that he's picking up what she's putting down.
I also thought it was really funny that she called him a strong and silent international man of mystery.
Oh, yeah. Though, to be honest, it kind of just reminds me of Austin Powers a bit, which I guess it kind of tracks because it's a spoof of 1960s spy films. And then we have that connection earlier in the book to, what was it, the Ipcrest file, right? So that was another 1960s spy film.
You know, interesting that she calls him international man of mystery because he's not.
Oh, shit. But with the Americans.
Yeah.
It's a
maybe
clue.
He will be.
Lindsay, you connected the dots.
Thank you.
You did it. I love it.
You can't forget the detective emojis, too.
Oh, yeah. I'm honestly surprised she didn't break out the old Sherlock Big Cock name for him, to be honest.
I think if she knew about it, she would have.
I don't think a better moniker could ever exist for him.
You know what? I'm going to be honest. I judge Bijou for all kinds of things. But
oh, yeah.
I can't pretend that texting is one of them because I, too, am all over the emojis as punctuation thing. And, you know, I'm not a hyper. I would send the exact same eggplant detective kind of thing. But now my question is, Lindsay, can you make me a friendship bracelet that says SASIMOM on it, please? Like maybe with eggplant beads.
Wait, what does it stand for?
It's the Strong and Silent International Man of Mystery.
Yeah. Sassy mom.
Sassy
I want
mom.
A friendship bracelet with little eggplants and sassy mom.
You know what? I can because I have about 5,000 leftover beads from the Eras tour. So
Nice.
And looking on Amazon, they actually do have little eggplant charms.
Outstanding.
So
beautiful.
You know what though? This whole thing with Bijou texting and the emojis has made me very self-conscious of using emojis on Twitter.
Oh, no.
I'm like, oh, no, I can't do it because everyone's going to be like, you're Bijou.
I'm still going to do it.
The other thing that these books have made me self-conscious of is cleaning before company comes over.
Oh, my God.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, no, they're going to smell the pledge because every time it says he could tell that they had cleaned because they were vacuum marks and he smelled the pledge and like, oh, no.
So rude.
Or when he goes to Robin's and it doesn't have that.
Oh,
he concludes that she must be a clean person.
She's
and
just
I'm like,
a clean
oh, no.
person and they're not
know.
A panic cleaner.
Yeah.
Now here's where Strike gets a call from Abigail and she's after more information before agreeing to talk.
Interesting that she doesn't seem to mind someone trying to get a family member out of the church, but her biggest concern was whether or not Strike was interested in Kevin's book. Which tells me, or it should have told me, that Abigail was afraid of something Kevin either knew or that she suspected he knew.
I wonder if she's worried that Kevin might have stashed another copy of his book somewhere as a backup.
Oh, yeah.
Because if I were her, I'd have been sitting there this whole time absolutely consumed with anxiety that Strike knew that I'd missed something killing Kevin and he was on to me.
I think she is.
Yeah.
I think that's what's happening.
That's what's driven her to call him back, right? Be like, okay, I need a meeting so that I can see...
Yeah.
If this is a trap and he's going to arrest me, you'd have to know.
Abigail does eventually agree to meet, but not at her flat.
Yeah, she gives the excuse that her lodger is nosy. But I wonder if he hadn't been there, if Abigail would have been okay with Strike interviewing her at home, because I'm just thinking that would have been a major troubled blood parallel to interview the killer in her home with evidence all around.
It would have been. She might not have wanted him poking around in there.
Yeah. Don't let him go to the bathroom, Abigail.
Never. Let Strike go to the bathroom. The motto for murderers everywhere.
If he has to go to the bathroom, you better be prepared to go to jail.
All right, should we go to chapter 26?
In chapter 26, Becca continues to lead Robin's group through the farm, and Robin attends a joyful meditation with Mazu. All right, the epigraph for this chapter. The joyous is the lake. It is a sorceress. It is mouth and tongue. It means smashing and breaking apart. And that is from chapter 3 of the Book of Changes.
Sounds so strange to say chapter.
Right?
This is the first epigraph that doesn't come from a hexagram. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This comes from the discussion of the trigrams in the opening. The trigrams are the individual groups of three lines that are paired together, one over, one under, to make the hexagrams of six lines, right?
Yeah.
So this image is referring to tree. The lake is actually coming up in the hexagram for chapter 28. The lake is one of the trigrams in that.
I think the word joyous here is a direct connection to the joyful meditation. And then with our introduction to Mazu, we have our sorceress. smashing and breaking apart might be pointing at Mazu's dangerous nature.
Absolutely, yes. And that it's the lake, I think, is really fitting for Mazu as well, because of all the water imagery and the depth of the baptismal pool that she is overseeing. Yeah. The Pool of Horrors. But yeah, I agree about the smashing and breaking apart pointing at Mazu's dangerous nature, because Robin, the moment she is in Mazu's presence, feels that sense of fear, the revulsion.
Yeah.
And it's our first look at this very nasty witch. Not a good witch.
We start the chapter back with Robin, and the fire group is taken from the crafting room to the animals.
It says that Jang is left in charge, and it mentions his eye twitch again. Mm. I got curious about eye twitching and if it meant anything in particular.
Symbolic meaning.
Yeah. And I found that a left eye twitching signifies good luck, but the right eye twitching symbolizes bad fortune or unluckiness.
Ooh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Being born into this cult is pretty bad fortune, for sure. So that fits.
I suppose it does fit him. Do you think there's any other significance to this? Like, are we seeing another Cyclops or...
What struck me was the sort of parallel callback to Ink Black Heart when Strike's right eye starts twitching. Mm. Remember when he's at the hospital?
Yeah.
For Strike, it was a symptom of this extreme stress that's building. So perhaps we're supposed to assume that Jang is under some kind of stress as well. The cognitive dissonance required to function in the UHC is making him crack.
I think that's fair, because a couple times in some chapters coming up, we see it starts twitching when he sees Mazu or in front of certain people that might stress him out.
Mazu would stress me out as
Mazu might make my eye start twitching too, yeah.
By the way, I love that they get to interact with the animals, because as you guys know, I love the animals. I think I'd be friends with all of them. But there's some commotion when Marion falls in the mud and it said that the pigs charged at the ones holding the food. And I just love that we get more of Robin's farm background here, with her thinking about the right way to get the pigs in the pen. And that's a piece of information that I've filed away in my brain, just in case I'm ever put in this situation, by the way. To get pigs in the pen, you have to put the food in the trough first and open the gate so they come to get the food.
Well, that sounds logical.
Yeah, it does.
It's probably normal pig behavior, but I remember kind of raising my eyebrows a bit, because the sort of aggressive introduction to the pigs, where they're charging at someone. Because, of course, I was familiar with the theory that the pigs ate someone.
Yeah, I think we all knew as soon as pigs showed up that they were going to be eating someone. Glad they didn't eat Marion, I guess.
Okay, and then now we're going to start our joyful meditation. The whole thing, to me, is very strange.
Well, laughing meditation, laughter meditation is actually a real thing.
I know.
It's weird to you.
It doesn't make it less strange.
It's done basically the same way as described in the book. So it's supposed to improve your well-being, reduce depression and anxiety, calm the mind, release the emotions, because apparently laughter equals dopamine and serotonin. And it makes sense that they would have them do this now, because it floods their brain with all the happy chemicals after such an exhausting, painful, boring day. They're basically making them love bond themselves and trauma bond with each other. It's pretty good strategy.
Sure. Yeah.
I want to try this, actually. Because, you know, you put on a smile and eventually you start feeling happier.
No, I don't know.
You don't know that?
I would have loved to either have seen Strike have to do this or just hear Robin telling him about it. Because I feel like he and I would have similar reactions.
I feel like you would, yeah. The chapter ends with Mazu apparently opening the door with her pure spirit powers. So this is definitely a trick. Robin, of course, realizes that there's a hidden mechanism to do this, as anyone with a single brain cell would.
Right.
I'm actually astonished that anyone in this group on day one would be like, oh my God, it's magic. You guys have been to a supermarket before, right? You've seen you've seen automatic doors. You're aware that this technology exists. But it makes me wonder if someone is watching Mazu and hitting the button at the right time, or if Mazu herself has a little switch hidden in her pocket to trigger it or what.
Oh, yeah.
Which seems
possible. I'm curious about that too. I wonder what would happen, what they would do if it didn't work for some technical reason.
Technical difficulty. She just stares and points at the door and nothing happens.
I bet she would blame it on them. Like someone here is messing with the...
There's this dark-sided.
Yeah.
There's a dark-sided spirit.
I'm sure that's what she'd do.
Oh, that would be so funny though.
Yeah, it would be. Why do you think that J.K. Rowling chose to give Mazu these noticeably uneven eyes?
So this was interesting to me as well, because I felt like I'd read this in these books before, and I did. Yeah. Jason in Career of Evil, you remember the young...
Oh yeah.
Trans-abled guy.
How could I forget?
The one they interviewed with
it's
Tempest.
It's like, you can forget Jason, but you can't forget Tempest.
You can't forget Tempest. If I say the guy with Tempest, everyone's like, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Jason. We know him. Yeah.
He also had the same thing with one eye higher than the other. And it was on him, they were described as making him look oddly vulnerable. But here, they're sinister. It's not quite the same thing. But Rokeby and Al both have a divergent squint that makes their eyes look asymmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, these characters with asymmetrical eyes, my first impulse is to say that they're a symbol that the way the character sees the world is off kilter in some way.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Their eye is a hint that they're seeing the world in a way that's not reality.
I think your first impulse is pretty accurate there. Yeah. She has these uneven eyes and Jang has the eye twitch.
Oh yeah.
They say the eyes are the, what do people say?
The window to the soul.
The window to the soul, yeah.
And then there's something off with hers.
Wace and Tayo both have those large blue eyes.
Yeah, that's the genetic link.
That ties them to Lin too.
And Abigail.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's all about the eyes.
I want to hear more about Strike's eyes.
I too want to hear more about Strike's eyes, preferably while Robin is looking deeply into them.
Yeah, well, obviously that's how it would come up in my head.
Obviously, yes.
They've just been described as dark. I assume that he has brown eyes.
Yeah, dark brown, probably.
Dark brown, yeah. All right, well, that's the end of this episode. What are we doing in the next one, Kenz?
We are doing chapters 27 and 28. So that is going to cover Robin's first dinner at Chapman Farm. And then Strike also interviews Abigail Glover. And that is a long chapter.
A bit of an insult calling what she eats at dinner.
It's technically sustenance.
We'll get to that.
It's technically edible.
Best you can say about it.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.